World War III update. Day X approaches. It's going to be a wild week. In the last 48 hours, a massive ordinance was dropped in southern Lebanon that some people suspect was a nuclear weapon. I'm here to assure you that it was not. Accompanied by hundreds of other airstrikes on different targets in southern Lebanon that didn't seem to have a whole lot of effect, to be honest, there was this massive explosion that was caught on film and was rumored to be a tactical nuclear strike. Number one, the explosion just simply isn't big enough. The flash of light that occurs beforehand is not big enough. If they were to have detonated this so close to the southern Lebanese and Israeli border, there would have been massive radioactive blowback, and you would be able to measure it because, of course, in a ground-based detonation, there's a lot more radioactive fallout. And to do something on the eve of the United Nations Security Council meeting, and so early, so nascent in the conflict, would be considered unconscionable, even for Israel. So no, this was not a nuclear detonation, but perhaps the speculation surrounding it is a harbinger for what is most certainly to come. Now, as I said, this had very little effect on Hezbollah's capabilities. Israel has been shown a lot of success in terms of their covert assassination capabilities. The pager attack, which the jury is still out on the extent and how that exactly happened. I have some more information to share on that today. But also, you know, they've been very good in terms of their precision strikes on the upper echelons of the Radwan force and Hezbollah in particular. But when it comes to having a conventional war with Lebanon, I have a sneaking suspicion that they're going to get their ass kicked because of the terrain. This is very mountainous terrain. And they have a lot of bunkers. They have a lot of tunnel networks, which are far more advanced and extensive. And we're talking about, in this last 48 hours throughout these bombings, only, I think, a handful of soldiers, less than three soldiers, actually perished on the side of Hezbollah. And they're incredibly transparent with their, what they call their martyrs, okay? It's in line with their religious doctrine. They have to be very accurate in their disclosure of fatalities. The same is not true on the side of the secular West. We conceal everything. In fact, it's illegal right now to publish any sort of pictures or video footage of sensitive sites in and around Israel, especially in the north. So we'll never know. They're going to play the same game as they're playing in Ukraine, where you're never going to know the official numbers. And it's in the history books, they're never going to be able to discern how many people actually died, how many casualties there actually were, how many civilian casualties there actually were. But on the flip side, that's not true. And we know that despite all of this bombing, hundreds of bombs, millions, probably $100 million spent in this initial bombing raid by Israel, you're not even seeing a handful of casualties. And that means that these guys are dug in very deep. And it's a sign that when they do start rolling the tanks over, and in terms of anti-tank warfare capabilities, I mean, Hezbollah is just going to eat these tanks left and right, much more than Hamas. And then you're talking about a mountainous region where there's so many places to hide and take cover. It's going to be a war that Israel is likely not going to be able to win. But despite that, Netanyahu is committed to doing so. Now, we also have to talk about what's going on with Russia. In terms of, before we get into the Russian stuff, I want to talk a little bit more about this situation. But essentially, here's what's going on. So next week, after this UN Security Council meeting in New York City, the rumor is from multiple reputable sources that the United States and the UK have made a covert pact with Ukraine that they will indeed allow and greenlight strikes into Russia using NATO weaponry. This, of course, will be a massive escalation. We have to talk about a failed nuclear weapons test, or so-called failed nuclear weapons test. It actually wasn't, as more information has come out about it on the Russian side, and a few other anomalies. A lot of big ammunition depots have been struck inside Russia once again, which is leading some people to speculate that perhaps NATO weaponry is already operational in this capacity. And we also, of course, need to break down a little bit further what exactly is going on in Lebanon and what sort of effect this is going to have on the region. There, no doubt, this is the beginning of a massive war in the region. Some people suspect that this was a Moab, possibly a bunker-busting weaponry. We don't know officially what it was just yet, but some people speculate that it was this, and that would explain the secondary explosion, which could have been caused by hitting its target in a buried missile silo, a bunker, possibly. So here is, to give you some perspective of where we're at, okay, so this is Israel right here. This is Lebanon, obviously. These concentric circles represent the range and the arc of fire of various types of weaponry that is in Hezbollah's arsenal. Of course, they can cover all of Israel. Now, they've only been using their stuff typically within 40 kilometers of the border. That's where the majority of the fighting has been. 40 kilometers on either side of the border, with Israel's ordnance penetrating a lot further and, of course, doing a lot of covert operations with the cyber attack thing that we'll talk about more in a moment. There's more information about that, which is incredibly important and people need to know. But essentially, we've barely made it beyond the first, their shortest range of missiles, okay? Let me see if I have a picture of those missiles somewhere here. So we have the FAR 1 and 2, which is what I think they were using. And they also have the FAR 3 and 5. So essentially now they've expanded the arc of fire out to 75 to 100 kilometers, meaning that Haifa is now a target. Israel has said that if you target Haifa, then that pretty much guarantees world war. So they have their casus belli. Netanyahu is looking to provoke the Hezbollah into attacking, doing deeper strikes, doing more strategic strikes, which will give him every justification that he needs to go to war and quite possibly bring the United States into that conflict, which is what they're going to need to do for a ground-based operation. There is no situation where Israel has the manpower in order to do a ground-based operation, a sustained one, whilst minimizing casualties. So what we're likely going to see is the arc of fire expand, because every time Lebanon responds, Israel responds disproportionately. So far, Hezbollah's response has been quite measured, but again, we won't know the effects of that response because it's now illegal to publish any information, and this bears repeating. There's a lot of disinformance on the western side, if you can consider Israel the western side, suggesting that these most recent barrage of strikes by Hezbollah into Israel on David's air base in particular were ineffective. Yet it's impossible for us to ever know conclusively because, of course, it's illegal to publish. So you see the kind of predicament. Now, we know from the past, if you watch this channel regularly, the last time there was a volley of exchange on both sides, Hezbollah, it said that they were able to successfully strike multiple air bases throughout Israel. Israel said that everything was shot down. We showed you video that actually showed you these rockets, albeit not very big rockets and not very powerful, but very precise, falling on a military base inside Israel. That information was never published. It was swept under the rug. So we know that Hezbollah is having a lot more success than perhaps what is being showed in Israel. The same playbook being used in Ukraine is going to be used in Israel, which calls into question pretty much all of the, you know, historical numbers when it comes to war, because how do you know that both sides aren't just manipulating the numbers in order to curry favor with their population or for strategic purposes? So we're never really going to know what the actual losses is unless you're going and counting obituaries. And even then, numbers can be greatly concealed. What we do know is that more recently, we're seeing a lot more in terms of the escalation, in terms of the range and the arc of fire. So this is a nice graphic to demonstrate and to show the disproportionate use of force. So these are all the Israeli strikes into Lebanon. These are all the Lebanese strikes. And I have a running joke right now is that every time Israel strikes Lebanon hard, eradicating the upper echelons of their command structure, or whatever sort of James Bond type stuff they do, we will see Nasrallah retaliate with a massive, long-winded speech, which will hopefully put the Israeli IDF leaders to sleep long enough that they can sneak a few rockets in. But it hasn't been going well. What Hezbollah is likely looking for is Israel to enter, get their tanks to enter into the killing fields into southern Lebanon. And I think that's what they're hoping for. They're getting ready to fight a defensive war. That's how they're oriented. This allegedly is David's Air Force Base, which was struck. This is an image, and I cannot confirm the veracity of the image. But we know that there was very likely a lot of hits that Israel took due to the information blackout. Now, this is Al Jazeera in the West Bank. And I'm not going to show all this footage. I'm just going to show clips of it. Basically, the IDF went into Al Jazeera, which is a predominantly pro-Western media, despite some of the criticisms and the stories which might contradict the prevailing views in Western media. They are very light in terms of their Eastern slant. I would say Haaretz, which is an Israeli publication, is even more critical of Israel than Al Jazeera. So the fact that they're going in here means that they're getting ready to, they're doing this clampdown on the media because they know a massive escalation is coming. Now, this is going to be in place for the next 45 days. And Al Jazeera, like them or not, tend to provide some alternative perspective, which is needed in a war zone. If you want to objectively be able to ascertain what is going on, you need multiple sources because you know both sides are going to lie. And the lie, they'll consider it a noble lie. So Israel might lie and say that, well, we're protecting our population from panic. We're trying to minimize exposure to our assets to the adversary. But, you know, it's a slippery slope because, of course, then it becomes very dictatorial, martial law-esque and authoritarian if you continue down that pathway. So we know that Israel is pretty much full of shit when it comes to reporting what's going on. Now, this is a hospital that I think has moved fully underground into an underground parking lot in the Haifa region or in some northern part of Israel. So they are prepared for a massive war in the north. A war is coming in the north. There is no doubt about that. For preppers, it's important to take note that these underground parkades would be probably places that would be the best, the most well-built to withstand any sort of conventional war, but possibly also the effects of nuclear war. And we're going to have a video coming up soon, which is going to talk about places that you might be able to retreat to if you unfortunately find yourself in the thick of an urban city that might be subject to a nuclear attack. So one thing you can say for the Israelis is that they are very prepared. They're getting ready to send their tanks to the southern Lebanon recycling depot. Merkava tanks spotted once again. They're slowly accumulating in the southern Lebanon direction. And we have Netanyahu, Gallant, and Halevi have reached a decision for gradual escalation with Hezbollah without entering into a full-scale war, they claim. So I don't know how you claim to do that when you're effectively attempting to target the leader of the opposition. It would be one thing if they weren't going for the upper echelons, if they weren't going for Nasrallah himself, but it's pretty clear that they're trying to take out the Hezbollah leadership and eradicate it, meaning full-scale war. So there's no way they can do what meet their goals without it escalating to a full-scale conflict. So indeed, escalation is imminent. They're also, of course, referring to this as a war against Iran. This is not just about Hezbollah. They view it as a proxy of Iran. And such, they're trying to create the precedent required in order to go to war with Iran. At the same time, Iraq has launched the largest ever drone attack on Israel since 1991. Okay? So that is pretty serious. That means that the entire axis of resistance, who's been remarkably quiet, and I think that these were just rogue elements, I don't think this was the big attack, are starting to coordinate their attacks a lot more. I think what we're likely going to see in the next leg up of this conflict is a coordinated strike by the Houthis, maybe the Iranians, because remember, they're still well overdue. They have two reasons now. The assassination of Haniyeh that took place back in July, as well as what was the other thing that just happened, their ambassador who was blinded by the pager strike. So they have multiple reasons to shoot, fire some more missiles into Israel. It's just a matter of when they're going to do it and are they going to coordinate those attacks with Hezbollah. Here's what Lindsey Graham has to say about going to war for Israel. Everybody loves good Lindsey Graham soundbite.
Do not give up on normalization with Saudi Arabia. I know you got to deal with Hezbollah. There was an imminent attack. But one or two things have to change in the Mideast. We need to make game-changing peace, which is reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Israel, or game-changing military strategy. Go into Lebanon to establish a buffer zone won't work unless you hit Iran. To my friends in Israel, you're fighting the proxies. Fight the source, the great Satan, Iran. To the Biden administration, you've let Iran run wild. You've given them $80 billion of relief on sanctions. They're rich. They're running wild. And now's the time to hit the source of the...
Okay, just for clarification, the GDP of Iran is north of $1 trillion easily. So that sanctions relief has really done anything in that respect is a bit of a misnomer. In terms of his, I'm not sure what he is implying in terms of what the expectation is and how they're going to neutralize Iran. I can't see anything else but a full-scale war with Iran diminishing their capabilities. And we know that Lindsey Graham is a cheerleader for Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is the preferred choice of Netanyahu. Okay, Netanyahu greatly prefers Donald Trump over Kamala Harris. That is beyond evident. So that tells me that Trump has a very good chance of winning because we know how impactful and influential AIPAC is, the Israeli lobby is. It's no surprise at this point in time. There's no secret about it at this point. We know that they wield an exceptional amount of capability, not the only and likely not the most powerful lobby in the U.S., but they certainly have a lot of sway when it comes to getting politicians elected. And if you have Lindsey Graham and Netanyahu both backing the Trump campaign, who is saying, go out and buy Bitcoin, well, you know that a broader war in the Middle East is most certainly coming. Either way, what you're voting for this year is you're voting for a war in the Middle East or you're voting for a war with Russia. Most people would say, well, the Middle Eastern war is better because it won't go nuclear as fast. But remember, Russia's strategic interests are now tied to Iran's, which means that no matter which war starts, it's likely going to end in a nuclear showdown one way or the other. Now, we need to talk about, very briefly again, I want to show you this. This is an Energizer lithium battery, okay? So they undo it, they pull out what I believe is, I'm not sure if this is the lithium or if this is the nickel or what, but they're essentially just showing you how easy it is to detonate these things, okay? And that the explosive potential of these things. So they unwrap it, the anode and the cathode there. And so they fold this material up, which I presume is some kind of, is this nickel or what would that be for all the scientists in the house? They throw it in some water and it starts smoking. It catches on fire and then it goes boom and it shatters the glass. And that was just from one tiny little battery. You throw in some shrapnel from the device itself, and you got yourself a miniature bomb. Now, of course, we still don't know anything more than what these three anonymous officials from the U.S. government, as cited by New York Times, tell us about this incident. They've implanted into everybody's minds that there's definitive evidence to show that these were explosives that were put in these devices, yet there is no conclusive proof of that yet. We haven't seen or heard anything from Hezbollah or the Russians, who allegedly have gotten a hold of some of these things from the Lebanese government and Hezbollah to analyze. There is no conclusive proof so far that these devices did have components that were explosive inside them. Now, there's so many question marks here, and the Israelis put out a story recently suggesting that they were able to selectively target whose device actually detonated, of course, to absolve themselves of any sort of criticism that this was a careless act, which could have led to untold collateral effects should some of these had gone off in an airplane, or if a bus driver or something to that effect, or that could have impacted countries outside of Lebanon, because of course people would have been traveling. So in an attempt to absolve themselves of that criticism, they've floated this story now that they were able to selectively target whose device detonated. Now, if you're Iran, and if you're any other country throughout this region, you're looking at your devices right now. And if you had any sort of interaction, whether a good or bad, with the Mossad or the CIA, you're looking at your devices and you're seriously wondering whether or not it's a ticking time bomb, whether or not it has explosive material. I show you this to show you that this is a game-changing revelation, because regardless of whether or not it has the explosive potential to kill you or maim you or blind you, as what happened with most of the Hezbollah fighters and support staff, this has a massive potential in terms of just its pre-war potential. So to detonate devices, to affect communication lines, we must presume now that there is a cyber capability out there to, and this has always been the case, obviously, because they're claiming that this has been worked on for 15 years. But again, I think that's a bit of a red herring just to take attention away from this. Very well could have just been a cyber attack, and they found some way to manipulate the lithium ion batteries in order to explode. And if that's the case, that means every possible electronic device could be weaponized at some point in time, and maybe only weaponized to the extent that it means that that device will be destroyed. But that could have massive disruptive effects on society. So I think that there's a lot more to this story that requires explanation, and I'm not sure we're ever going to have all the details. We'll only have the details that the powers that be want us to have. Now, here's what's going on in Russia. The Cosmodrome exploded. There was a Sarmat missile that was supposed to be tested recently, and it blew up. Now, some people are saying, hey, this is a sign that Russia's nuclear arsenal, I think Peter Zion tweeted out that maybe we should not overestimate Russia's nuclear capabilities, because clearly, based on some of the revelations that we've seen since the beginning of the Ukraine conflict in terms of the fallibility of their missile defense and obviously the unreliability of some of their weapon systems, that we shouldn't overestimate their capabilities. But understand that this is a newer weapon system, and the Russians still have over 1,000 nuclear warheads mounted on proven technologies like ICBMs and submarine launch ballistic missiles that do work and that have worked and have been proven to work. This very well could have been an accident completely unrelated to the launch. It could have been a sabotage operation. Now, if this was a sabotage operation, which the more I think about it seems even more likely, and if that is the case, then the DEFCON level just ticked upwards once again. There is a very strong possibility that this indeed was some level of sabotage, because this wasn't a planned launch, or at least it was not in the process of launching when this event happened. So if this was a Ukrainian saboteur job, a NATO sabotage job, or NATO's I don't know, somehow was able to do some sort of cyber attack or something, you know, that then we're definitely getting into dangerous, perilous levels of escalation here. And of course, in the last 3 days, we've seen multiple arsenal ammunition depots gone up in smoke by utilizing Ukrainian drones. They are saying, now here's one of those. Now, I don't think these are drones. I think these are definitely missiles, because in order to target these hardened bunkers that these ammunition depots possess, you need some bunker busters, okay? Some of these are built to be nuclear proof, and Ukraine has dusted three of them in just 3 days. And if that's just the beginning, then of course that's a conventional attritional rate that the Russians cannot sustain, making the likelihood of them using nuclear weapons ever more as time progresses. But here's another one of those detonations that recently occurred. As you can see, this was a massive explosion. This definitely looked like an ammunition depot. This was not a nuclear explosion. I know it looks like one. Remember that there could be all kinds of rockets, with long-range rockets, liquid-fueled rockets, so you're getting a lot of rocket fuel in there, and it looks like a mushroom cloud. I mean, that is a massive explosion. That's not the biggest one that we showed you the other day. This is just another one. So most people don't realize that this is going to be now become the norm, and this is why when the USA and the UK are harboring plans to secretly let Ukraine strike deep into Russia, I think that the Russians are already on a DEFCON 2 level status. I think it's arguable that Europe is also on DEFCON 2, perhaps not in the American command, NORAD. Maybe we're not at DEFCON 2, which is silly considering that we are provoking the Russians into using some sort of nuclear weapon. Some are speculating that they are going to utilize their ICBMs for their kinetic effects, which, of course, if you've heard of, what was it called? It was called Rods from God or something like that. Back in the day, they had this plan to utilize kinetic weapons. So there's no actual explosive ordnance or very little. It's almost like the effect of a meteor hitting the earth. And so if you can get a heavy piece of metal, and if you can just hurtle it towards the earth at Mach 20 or whatever sort of crazy speed that these ICBMs are traveling, then it can have a massive explosive effect, and it's still technically conventional. Some people are suspecting that maybe that's what they're going to utilize. But nonetheless, we must understand what Lavrov has explicitly stated over and over again. He says, nobody wants a nuclear war. We've said this many times, but I dare to assure you that we have the weapons that will have very serious consequences for the owners of the Ukrainian regime. Of course, he's talking about the UK, who provide the security detail, and the United States, who provide a lot of the ISR, okay? And he says that these weapons are available and they are a state of full combat readiness. Full combat readiness. And so if we are seeing sabotage acts inside Russia on their most advanced weapon system, of course they have multiple new weapon systems of this sort. There's the Belgorod, and some of these perhaps have been untested, as well as the Avangard, the Zircon, and the Kinzhal have now been tested. This is the result of one of their ammunition depots, a newer one in Turopets. So this is a massive depot, and you could see it was pretty much completely destroyed, okay? There's nothing left of it. And some Russia bros are still coping and saying that, oh yeah, this is no big deal. You know, it's just 60, 70% of everything destroyed. That's catastrophic failure. I can't remember what the actual percentage is to be considered a catastrophic failure for something like this, but that's catastrophic. I mean, you know, it's not even so much the weaponry, it's the facility itself that's incredibly costly. The Russians have released an animation showing what a 750 kiloton warhead will do to London, and, you know, showing the blast radius, radioactive fallout, etc., etc., the usual stuff. Some people are suspecting that the Russians are short on manpower because the Russian aircraft carrier crew has been sent to the front lines in Ukraine. Is that indicative that they're running short on material and manpower? It could very well be. We know that the Russians have expanded their military draft, so they're going to be mobilizing more soldiers. According to Ben Hodges, the pro-Western former, I believe he was a general, he is claiming that Ukraine has the ability to strike the Kerch Bridge and detonate the Kerch Bridge, but they're not going to do it until they're ready to follow it up with a massive offensive into Crimea. So it might explain why it hasn't happened yet, that they don't want to do it, and they don't want to burn that kinetic zero day, if you will, until the time is right. Zelensky is on his way to beg for more money for Ukraine and to get us all into nuclear Armageddon. We have Joe Biden completely shitting the bed in India. This one was, this was probably the worst. I'll play it for you guys. This was the worst yet by far. Okay. So he's in India. He has, I guess, completed a speech, and then he kind of just forgets what's happening.
So I want to thank you all for being here. So I want to thank you all for being here.
Is that so now, quiet?
Who am I introducing next? Who's next?
So he says, so I want to thank you all for being here. And now, who am I introducing next?
Who's next?
Everybody's like, what the fuck? And Modi, the Indian president or prime minister, finally gets up and
distinguished guests,
and then the announcer
the prime
comes
minister
on.
Of the Republic of India.
Modi's like, oh shit, it's over. It is over. This is why they got Biden on vacation, okay? TikTok deletes Sputnik accounts, which is surprising considering the relationship between China and TikTok. But of course, TikTok is trying to appease its U.S. regulators by complying with sanctions and enforcing the new Iron Curtain, which is being, in fact, enforced by the West and not the East. We also have this. This is, I believe, in San Francisco somewhere. A bunch of people on bikes decide to raid a convenience store. Understand, this is the country with the global reserve currency, okay? You have biker gangs of bandits going from store to store like locusts, devouring businesses. And this is the country that has the global reserve currency. Are you confident in the integrity of the dollar? So what else do we have? I think that's about it for news today. You have the president of Iran in NYC, which is interesting. He's there for the UN Security Council meeting. So a lot is going to come out of this version of the Security Council meeting, I'm certain. There are speculations that the Hamas leader, Sinwar, might be dead. Although these are unconfirmed reports. If he is dead, then most certainly all of the hostages are as well. And that would be a green light for Israel to go in and finish the job. They're already giving tours in Israel of what they're calling the new beachfront property of Israel. And people are, I'm sure, are already starting to place their wagers on getting their hands on some of that beachfront property. It's very nice beachfront property that the Gazans had. Unfortunately, it's now been reduced to rubble. What else do we got here? I think that's about it, my friends. I'm going to let you go for today. If you want to support the channel, the best way to support it, CanadianPreparedness.com. We got everything you need to survive SHTF, the best preparedness food on the market. We got it. And we don't just do that bullshit drop ship stuff. Everything is from in-house in our warehouse. So we got 25, 30-year shelf life foods. We got the best water filtration systems. We got all of the survival knickknacks you could possibly want. We have all of the tools, the best axes, the best saws, the best knives that you could possibly want. We have clothing. We have backpacks from Eberle Stock to Maxpedition to VanQuest, the most advanced solar equipment, solar home systems, freeze dryers, you know, and pretty much everything. Anything a prepper could want, from body armor to less lethal type options, like bear spray, only to be used on bears if you're in Canada, that is. I have to legally state that, but everything you want, that's the place to do it. Use coupon code SURVIVALPREPPER for 10% off. I'm quite certain that when the panic starts, I mean, this is pre-SHGF, right? So just imagine these swarms of locusts when the shit actually hits the fan, and they're not doing this for luxury, they're doing this for survival. I think we're going to see some crazy shit when it goes down, and just the panic when this thing does escalate vertically, be it in the Middle East or Eastern Europe. People are going to be, it's going to make the toilet paper madness of 2020 seem like just a warm-up. I think we haven't even seen anything yet. That was toilet paper. Imagine a run on food. Imagine a run on gasoline. These are the things that you're going to have to prepare for. And that is why an ounce of preparation is worth a pound of cure. And that's the best way to support the channel, CanadianPreparedness.com. We got a lot of great stuff coming. Go check out the video we released yesterday that documents my 3-month journey into gardening. We were able to build out an orchard in 3 months. It's called a Centropic Food Forest. And basically it creates a system, a permaculture system, which uses a bunch of different mixes of annuals and perennials, big trees, medium trees, and small plants. And they all work together to maintain the soil for a very low maintenance permaculture setup, which will provide food indefinitely for a very large family. The best time to plant a tree was 10 years ago. The second best time is today, but you might want to do it, not want to do it now, because of course winter is on the horizon and you're not supposed to plant them that close to winter. But if you have a greenhouse, the best time to do it is now. So get it done while you can, because the shizzy is most definitely hitting the fizzy, and the price of gold is still exploding and surging day after day, and that's indicative of a lot of volatility. So stay up, my friends. We'll see you tomorrow.